KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, the writer Leslie Jamison is joining us to talk about her book on recovery from addiction and alcoholism. Jamison is an alcoholic. Though she's sober now, she wanted to write a book that explored whether the stories about getting better could ever be as compelling as the stories of falling apart. Could sobriety be as interesting as being drunk? Join us after this. Hi, it's Doug Fabrizio inviting you to go see our latest short film at Radio West Films. This is the animated story of Mormon pioneer Margaret Daglish. Walked to Utah with a handcart, suffered incredible hardship, and came out of it a survivor. The historian Will Bagley tells the story. The Utah animator Ainsley Romero brings it to life. Go see it at radiowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Let's be honest. There's a kind of romance in the story of a writer or poet who's fueled by alcohol. Sure, their lives are a mess, but just look how honest and brilliant. And this is part of a mythology Leslie Jamison writes about in a new book. This idea that booze may destroy your liver, but it sharpens your mind. Jamison is a writer herself, a really good one, and she's noticed that addiction makes you seek out the intensity of life, and so many of the writers that she loves manage to turn that intensity into really great art. She understands that intensity herself because she's an alcoholic, sober now, but she spent years struggling with that addiction and, frankly, with that mythology about booze and literature. Jamison says, difficulty is our most reliable narrative engine. Writing about recovery or happiness, that's harder. And here's the big question in her book. Can those stories about happiness be as interesting as the ones about torment? In other words, could she find examples of how sobriety also fed creativity? Today in the program, we're talking with Leslie Jamison about her new book. It's called The Recovering: Intoxication and Its Aftermath. Jamison teaches at the Columbia University MFA program. She's a frequent contributor to the New York Times Book Review, to Harper's, the New York Times Magazine. She joined us from a studio in New York City. Her book isn't a memoir, really. In fact, it's hard to pin down. She did know she didn't want it to be singular, as she puts it, because, as she writes, nothing about her recovery had been singular.
It's interesting to me that you would pull out that idea that it's a hard book to categorize, because we ran into that dilemma when we were trying to figure out what the subtitle should be. You know, it's called The Recovering, and we were thinking, well, what should it – should we call it a memoir? Should we call it a biography? Should we call it a cultural history? And eventually we decided on Intoxication and Its Aftermath, because it allowed us a little bit of room for it to be all of those things. And from very early on, I knew that I wanted to put my story into conversation with other stories. And part of that impulse came from the awe I felt at recovery as a place where part of what it meant to reexamine your own life involved sitting down and listening on a daily basis to the lives of other people. And I thought, would there be some way to reproduce that structure, the chorus of a meeting, in the form of a book? And that was one of the challenges that I set down for myself.
What did it mean for the way you wrote it? I mean, it seems like it was a different kind of writing in many ways for you, a different process. Maybe you talk about spending time in archives and doing interviews. I mean, that was new for you in that form, it seems.
Yeah, definitely parts of it. I mean, so for the book to include many stories, that meant I had to figure out both where to find those stories and how to tell those stories. And one set of stories that I ended up being really drawn to was the stories of writers and artists who had struggled with addiction, made addiction a part of their work, and also, in many cases, had tried to get sober or had gotten sober. And I was interested in the question of how sobriety had changed their creative lives. So those stories are part of the book. And in order to research those stories, I had not only read a lot of authors' work, so the poems of John Berryman, the stories of Raymond Carver, the novels of Jean Rhys, But I also spent a lot of time in their archives looking at the day-to-day texture of their drinking, their writing, their sobriety. But I knew that I didn't want the only stories in the book to be the stories of kind of famous addicts and alcoholics. And so I also spent quite a bit of time interviewing, quote unquote, ordinary recovering alcoholics. I put that in quotes because I think every life is pretty extraordinary. Yeah. And those interviews also ended up becoming part of the kind of chorus of the book.
I think you said at one point writing the book was like kind of the feeling of living in a house that kept growing all around you. And you just had to keep exploring these different rooms as they emerged.
Yeah, yeah. And my editor had to keep living in the growing house as well. I think at one point he ended up reading a manuscript that was about 800 pages long as it's when the accordion was fully pulled out. But yeah, I kept feeling the scope of the story I needed to tell kept getting larger. And so at a certain point, that also involved telling a kind of cultural history of how addiction and recovery have been narrated in 20th century America, and thinking about how race and class have inflected the stories we tell about addiction, and that I hadn't set out to think about those things at the very beginning of the book project, but it started to feel like a really urgent and necessary part of what it meant, not just to talk about addiction, but to talk specifically about this question of how do we tell stories about addiction. Hmm.
The first time you say you felt that buzz, you were 13. And you say early on, drinking began with your first blackout, or the first time you sought a blackout. That's how you put it in the book. Hmm. And you write that you wanted nothing more than to be absent from my own life. Would you explain what you mean? Because the way I connected that idea of being absent, I connected it to the later part of the recovery, which meant about being part of that chorus and telling the stories of strangers. Is there something there to that idea?
Absolutely. I think that's a great connection. And I think one way to think about recovery is a kind of radical and enduring presence. And so in that sense, it would be the opposite of absenting yourself from your own life. My first blackout wasn't an intentional blackout at all. I didn't even know what a blackout was. I describe this party in college that was I was getting inducted onto this literary magazine, and I had desperately wanted to be part of this magazine, was both eager to become part of this kind of literary world, but also really nervous in that world. And was I good enough? Was I smart enough? Was I witty enough? And so when that night that I was inducted, it was a really easy crutch to drink that first screwdriver, and then that second screwdriver, and that third screwdriver. And when I woke up the next morning and had pretty much zero memory of how I'd gotten back to my dorm or what had happened between the first screwdriver and waking up in my dorm, I thought I had been roofied, because I didn't know that blackouts were a thing that could happen, that you could just lose part of your own life. And so in no way was that an intentional act. But as my drinking progressed, I started to kind of crave the way in which drinking enough could make me pass out, or could at the very least kind of blunt all the voices that felt nonstop inside of me, the voices of sort of judgment, self-recrimination, self-consciousness, a sort of silencing of that apparatus of self-consciousness became one of the really appealing things to me about drinking. Yeah. And what it meant to get sober was in part sort of waking up to everything, you know, waking up to being fully aware, fully conscious, but also waking up to all the people who were inhabiting the world around me, and kind of listening to them and making space in my consciousness for them.
It's interesting you say that that idea of self-consciousness comes up when you write about, I think it was your first or one of your first AA meetings, where you're going through, as you describe it, the talking points of your pain. And you figure at some point, like, people are going to be impressed with this because you're a writer, and so you have insights and storytelling abilities, and how it seemed like this was, as you say, nothing compared to what the other people in that room had lived. But then there's this old man in this wheelchair who kind of brings you back into reality, and he just sort of shouts out, "This is boring." And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that, because you say it tapped into these veins of primal insecurity, and that was an important part of the story, I thought.
Yeah, I think for me, maybe partially because I've always wanted to be a writer, I've always thought about the imperative of telling stories that could compel other people, and in particular, turning my life into a story that could compel other people. And in that sense, sort of when I brought that set of insecurities and imperatives to recovery, it became about, well, can I tell a story that will be good enough to make me belong in this room or in this space? But one of the things that always felt like grace about recovery was that there was a very different model of why storytelling was valuable. Storytelling wasn't valuable because you were telling the most interesting story that somebody had ever heard, or the most beautiful story that somebody had ever heard. Storytelling was valuable because you were saying something that might resonate with another person in the room. And so when the old man yelled out, "This is boring," you know, it called on that kind of fragile, ego-driven self inside of me that felt like I always needed to be interesting. But later, I circle back to that anecdote and also describe, after the old man yells out, "This is boring," the woman next to me, you know, kind of put her hand on my arm as if to say, "Keep going." And once I was done, she said, "You know, you just told my story." And that's the sort of flip side of the imperative of being interesting. It's just the imperative of saying something that might be valuable to another person, which is less about sort of buffering the ego and more about maybe just being useful.
Well, this gets to what seemed to me, an important point in the book, and that the story of your recovery, or really anyone's recovery, just at first the idea, is that very interesting? Just the basic idea that recovery, is it as interesting a story or as meaningful as the story of addiction or self-destruction? Just like that's more interesting, the destructive part, not the recovery part. That could be tawdry and boring. And it seems like that's the thing you're getting at in the book.
That was certainly one of the motivating questions behind the book, was you know, can the story of getting better ever be as compelling or as seductive as the story of falling apart or radical dysfunction or kind of going off the rails? And I came to that question, honestly, both through sort of being drawn to a set of writers who had become infamous for their dysfunction, you know, some of our alcoholic luminaries like Carver and Berryman, and you know, even a female writer like Jean Rhys, whose dysfunction was often figured as a bit more pathetic but was still sort of part of her appeal, or Billie Holiday getting famous for her luminous pain. But I think, and also sometimes feeling in meetings like I was more interested when people were talking about how kind of crazy things had gotten than when they were talking about getting better. But, you know, I was genuinely interested in the possibility of telling the story of recovery in a way that was as dynamic. You know, a lot of times when you read addiction and recovery memoirs, even if they're called recovery memoirs, the recovery takes up kind of 10% of the space at the end of the book after the kind of more riveting tale of how bad things got. And I wanted to see whether I could write a book where the recovery took, you know, a solid half of the book and didn't lose the reader's interest, where you were sort of, once things were getting put back together, did that have a different kind of seductive, hypnotic energy that wasn't the energy of everything splintering off or splintering apart?
Jack London wrote this novel called John Barleycorn that you write about in the book. And in it, as you say, he conjured up two kinds of drunks. Explain this a little bit, because I guess he sort of imagined the sloppy drunk and then the brilliant drunk. And he wrote about how this is how he put it, the white light of alcohol granted access to these bleak truths, which seems to get at that mythology that you write about, that there's something about getting drunk or blitzed or just alcohol itself that gives you access to real truth. And that's what's so compelling about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I certainly believed at a certain point that when I got really drunk, I was encountering the secret, true, dark version of myself that was always festering underneath the kind of polite self of surfaces that was going out and meeting the world. And I think I kept encountering some version of that belief in many of the writers and artists that I was looking at. Patricia Highsmith talks about alcohol granting her access to sort of primal truths. John Barleycorn lays out that idea about alcohol as a useful force of illumination. There are other versions of the mythology. You know, some of the mythology of John Berryman was that alcohol both granted him access to dark truths, but was also how he survived that access, that it gave him a kind of it was the way he found comfort as he was confronting these like difficulties of what it meant to be alive. And, you know, so I was interested to find John Barleycorn, which was not a novel I was familiar with, as one of the sort of early incarnations of this idea that, you know, there's one model of the alcoholic who's kind of like a gutter drunk who's just shambling down the street, but that there's this other version of the alcoholic who's able to sort of see something that the rest of us can't quite see. And, you know, it wasn't that I ended up completely rejecting the idea that there are certain kinds of truths that people encounter in the throes of addiction that do generate beautiful work or that are worth articulating. But I ended up rejecting the idea that had some kind of monopoly on generative possibility or on creativity. And I was interested in thinking about, okay, well, addiction can yield access to certain truths, but also the process of extricating yourself from addiction can yield access to other truths.
Yeah. There's also this persistent idea that being ill is just more quote-unquote interesting. And you quote Susan Sontag about this nihilistic and sentimental idea of the interesting. And it seems like there's always been this idea that if you suffer, you're more complicated, that being healthy is banal, is maybe even vulgar, I think is how you describe it.
Yeah, that's also a quote from Sontag, where she's articulating this kind of binary between the interestingness of suffering and in certain cases, the interestingness of illness. She's particularly looking at tuberculosis as this illness that got associated with a sort of rarefied psychic state. And so she talks about that kind of, in contrast to that, the banality and vulgarity of being healthy. And, you know, certainly I felt that I had succumbed to my own version of that sort of reductive, believing in that reductive binary. And in writing this book, very much wanted to bring to life states of wellness or health that might have seemed to me tedious from the outside. So I write about, you know, what it felt like to date sober for the first time, where I was, you know, instead of having these like dim, boozy nights and candlelit bars, I was like hiking up this hill at dawn with like the taste of black coffee in my mouth, trying to make small talk with a stranger and just like showing up for that awkwardness, or, you know, meeting with other sober women and, you know, eating fruit salad and talking about why we had gotten drunk each night, but that there was something really rich about what was unfolding in those relationships and in those afternoons of fruit salad, even if it didn't have the same capital letter narrative intrigue that I had once associated with, like, the, you know, long nights of doing coke by a lake and waking up in a bed I didn't recognize.
Leslie Jamison, her book is The Recovering: Intoxication and Its Aftermath. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Do you have an old station wagon full of memories and a busted transmission? Yeah, join the club. Give that car, or any car, a new lease on life by donating it to KUER. We'll have it picked up for you, so really it couldn't be easier. Then we split the proceeds with our car donation partner, and the money goes straight into the programming you love to listen to in the car. It's a regular public radio circle of life. Look under the support tab at KUER.org to learn more about car donation.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer Leslie Jamison talking about her book about recovery. Jameson is an alcoholic. Though she's sober now, she wanted to write a book that explored whether the stories about getting better could ever be as compelling as the stories of falling apart. The book is called The Recovering: Intoxication and Its Aftermath. I want to ask about Raymond Carver and some of the other, as you describe it, the legends you inherited, all of those stories of dysfunction and, you know, brilliant writers getting drunk and getting fired and restocking their liquor stashes. Like this one where Raymond Carver is driving John Cheever to a liquor store in Iowa all the time, like first thing in the morning, right as soon as it opens, barely can get the car stopped before he jumps out to get there. I just wanted to ask you about Carver in particular, though, because you say that his shadow was the drunkest of them all. Talk a little bit about where he plays in this story, because I think it's so interesting where he was and then where he ends up.
Yeah. Well, I first encountered Carver, the kind of drunk mythology of Carver, and I, you know, really started reading Carver when I showed up at the Iowa Writers' Workshop in my early 20s, and his ghost very much haunts that town, both because he was a student at Iowa and came back to teach at Iowa, and, you know, his stories are still stories that people read there and often model their own work after. And so I had these visions of him as this kind of drunk rogue and, you know, thought about him getting drunk in the same, you know, wooden bar booths where I was getting drunk. Yeah. And it was only later that I realized that he had gotten sober and that actually a lot of the stories of his that I loved most were stories that he had written sober and stories whose genesis he really understood in terms of sobriety. When you look at some of the stories of his early sobriety, you can see not only references to drinking or trying to stop drinking, but you see a lot of moments between strangers where strangers are kind of trying to understand each other, trying to care for each other. And that seemed to me to be very beholden to the logic of recovery and the ways in which caretaking between strangers is a part of recovery. So I kind of discovered this second version of Carver. And I'm honest in the book about the ways in which I built that second version of Carver into a kind of mythology, yeah, the same way that, yeah, I had built the first version of Carver into a mythology. Sort of sober Carver became this kind of god or icon to me as well.
I found that interesting that once you got sober, you could reach for the myths of sobriety like you had reached, yeah, for the myths of drinking when you drank. You say you turned sober Carver into another higher power, and it wasn't any more real than the drunk one.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're, you know, it's both real and not real.
Right.
Like there, I mean,
yeah,
Carver did stop drinking, and he, you know, and he very much wrote from that place of sobriety, and you know, and a lot of the poems that he wrote in sobriety were really important to me because they understood sobriety not just in terms of deprivation or giving things up, but in terms of a kind of a rich life that had pleasure in it and an awareness of beauty. He talks about eating buttery popcorn and watching the lights on a distant hill in Port Townsend, where he lived in the, yeah, later part of his life. And this sense of sort of waking up to beauty and waking up to a kind of fresh, clear force in the world was really important to me rather than simply lamenting this thing that had been lost. But it's also true that I, you know, sort of painted the brushstrokes of sober Carver in my mind, you know, this living on this beautiful peninsula in Washington and sort of going out into the ocean each day and catching his fish and writing his poems. And, you know, and the truth was more complicated. Like, sober Carver also smoked a lot of pot and, like, did some coke. And, like, you know, it was actually a messier story. He also, you know, died of lung cancer from smoking. Like, you know, the stories of what it means to recover are often more complicated than simply, you know, you get better. But I think in that complexity, they don't undermine the life that he was able to find once he stopped drinking was also a different life than the one he would have found if he hadn't. And that's the truth, too.
You write in the book, every addiction story wants a villain. And you mention how America has never been able to decide whether addicts are victims or criminals. And so you write about this idea of how we make these divisions of psychic labor, you say, where we see alcoholics as tortured geniuses, but drug addicts as these deviant zombies. And you write about the legal system in this country that makes these distinctions. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about this, because this is an interesting part of the book.
As I started to interrogate the myths of the drunken genius that had like sustained me through much of my early 20s, I started to really wonder, well, why do we tell certain stories about some addicts and very different stories about others? Why did the crack addict in the 1980s get characterized as this betrayer of the social contract, this, somebody who was sort of corroding the lives of our cities? That was extremely racialized script where, you know, African-American drug addicts became villains, whereas white addicts were more often seen as figures who should be regarded with some kind of pity or compassion. And I think part of that comes back to the ways in which racialized scripts have been a part of our country's history from the beginning, that we're constantly finding different ways to scapegoat marginalized populations. And drug addiction has just been like one of the theaters of that scapegoating. And I also think it comes back to something about the paradox of addiction itself, where it's very hard, both inside of addiction and looking in on addiction, to understand why somebody keeps doing something that's destroying them. And so I think one of the scripts that we reach for in order to understand that paradox is, okay, this is a victim to be pitied. And another one of the scripts that we reach for is, you know, this is a villain and there's something morally wrong with what they're doing. And, you know, it's harder to sort of let those scripts live together or let those realities interact. And so I think we've done a lot of segregation where some addicts sort of take on that one part of how we see addiction as something you should be blamed for, and other addicts take on that other facet of addiction, something that for which you should be treated with compassion.
Yeah. You want to say something about George Kane? He fits into this part, I thought.
Yeah. So George Kane was an African-American writer who wrote a really incredible novel that was published in 1970 called Blues Child Baby. That's an autobiographical novel about a heroin addict named George Kane, who eventually by the end of the novel, he's been released from prison. He's trying to kick his heroin habit. He falls in love. He's sort of wandering around New York City. At a certain point, goes back to Newark, where his parole officer is. But by the end of the book, he has this new relationship, and he's determined to stay clean. And so there's a redemption story in it, but it's complicated and it's real and it's alive to the kind of messiness and pettiness of addiction too. But one of the things that was most moving to me about the book was not only the ways in which it's intelligent about addiction and intelligent about the social context of addiction, among other things. George Kane sort of predicts Nixon's war on drugs before it happens. So he says about the U.S. government, he says, you know, they say they're putting us in prison because we're addicts, but that's not the real reason they're locking us away, which is a pretty decent summary of Nixon's war on drugs. But I was also interested by the fact that George Kane himself, he wrote about a character getting clean, but he actually never managed to stay clean. He was a heroin addict who kept using even after this book came out. And that addiction was part of why he never wrote a second book. And I think part of why this first quite brilliant book has been largely forgotten. So I was really excited to talk about his book, to talk about it as telling one of the stories about addiction that we don't hear as often, and kind of bringing this forgotten book a little bit back into light. And I also sought out some of his family members and ended up interviewing his ex-wife to sort of fill out the picture of his biography a bit more. And exciting news that Blues Child Baby is going to be re-released next year by Echo. So it'll hopefully find a larger readership and a kind of a second life.
Another thing you've talked about is, and it seems like it's one of the issues that's an important theme in the book, is how, as you put it, it codes differently when a woman loses control compared to a man. And this is something you write about. Jean Rhys, for example, is this really, I have to say, really poignant story. And you tell about her infant son in the hospital, had a severe case of pneumonia. To calm her down, her husband gives her some champagne, and she's basically drinking when he dies in the hospital, and how that affects the way she's thinking. She never really, I guess, really never forgives herself. And this part, this role of a woman, how it's different, is interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really, there's so much about Jean Reese's life that's heartbreaking. And I think that story of her son's death is like the crux of it in a certain way. And his ghost is the ghost that she's haunted by, I think, for the rest of her life. And that sense that while he was dying, she was drinking, I think was just this deep wound that she never really recovered from. But I was interested both in Jean Reese, in figuring Jean Reese as kind of more than a victim or more than a figure of heartbreak, by looking at the ways in which she also managed to create incredibly intelligent, incredibly beautiful work that was honest about how drinking affects the psyche, what brought on the urge to drink, what it was trying to forget. Often her female characters are trying to forget things. Sometimes they are literally trying to forget the death of a child. But the ways in which she sort of used her pain to create both acts of sort of fictional self-disclosure, but also extraordinary acts of imagination, culminating in Wide Sargasso Sea, which is her reimagining of Jane Eyre, and sort of plucking this fictional figure from the margins into which she'd been kind of sort of Rochester's first wife, and Jane Eyre is sort of figured as this mad woman in the attic, and Jean Reese reimagines her backstory and says, well, what brought her to this place of confinement? And so there's a kind of radical empathy in that that I think comes from the ways Jean Reese had felt herself to be misunderstood. But I was also interested in Jean Reese as a way of thinking about, you know, maybe Raymond Carver when he drinks, or John Berryman when he drinks, they become these like roguish figures of genius. But Jean Reese, when she drinks, seems somehow pathetic often, is framed as kind of indulging in a certain kind of self-pity. And I think a lot of that comes back to different gender expectations for caregiving. So women are supposed to take care of people. That's one of the most abiding cultural scripts that attaches to them. And so when a woman is drinking, or when a woman is losing herself or losing control of herself, often that's figured as an act of negligence. She's losing control when she should be taking care of someone else. Yeah. And so I think there's a kind of judgment that often creeps into the woman who's abandoned control that doesn't always apply to men.
And who was it that wrote, when a woman drinks, it's as if she were an animal or a child?
It's Marguerite Duras,
right?
And that her voice is an important part of this book as well, because she was also, you know, almost adamant about speaking about her drinking and not necessarily apologizing for her drinking. I think in part because she was tired of these ways that a woman's drinking got figured as something pitiable or pathetic.
Jean Reese never really, quote unquote, recovers. Doesn't seem like, and it's amazing. She, as you say in the book, it's amazing how long she lived, given how much she drank.
Yeah. Some of the most wrenching documents that I found in any of the archives that I looked at were these notebooks in Jean Reese's archives, which are the University of Tulsa. And I've always felt like Jean Reese would have hated ending up at the University of Tulsa. Like, she was so committed to this kind of life of cosmopolitan glamour and spent time in London and Paris, and like her papers at the University of Tulsa. But she had a set of sort of younger caregivers, mainly younger female friends, who looked after her during the last years of her life. And I found this notebook that Diana Melli, one of these caregivers, had kept, with a sort of set of instructions for anybody who was taking care of Jean. And they included things like, you know, put a lot of ice cubes in her whiskey glass so that it'll seem like you've poured her more than you have, or avoid talking about painful subjects around twilight, because that's when she tends to get sad. And, you know, it was at that point, it wasn't about the fantasy of her drinking ending. It was more like, this woman is is going to drink. That's a part of her life. How can we keep her from doing the worst kind of damage that she could do? And there was something about this collective endeavor to manage her drinking that just, you know, made me feel like, right, this she never shook this. But I wanted to tell her story, and in particular the unrecovered story, well, for a couple reasons. One was that I, you know, part of what it meant for this book to include 15 stories rather than just my story was that those 15 stories could show the many different paths that addiction can take, where sometimes you get sober, sometimes you try to get sober and can't stay sober, sometimes you get sober and commit suicide, sometimes, you know, you get sober and find happiness but die of lung cancer. Like, you know, there are an infinite number of ways it can go, and I couldn't show all those infinite paths, but I could show a number of paths. And Jean Reese's path, where, you know, she never really got better, but, you know, she did many extraordinary things anyway, was, you know, felt like one of those important stories to tell.
John Berryman's story, I have to say that you write about seeing edits on an early draft of one of his books. Just Recovery, I guess it was, the book that he was writing, just showed how difficult it was. Say something about that. I was really drawn to this part of the story. Just it gave you a real sense, as he's writing a book about recovering, just how difficult it is.
Yeah. So John Berryman, you know, was famous for his poems, and in particular his gorgeous and strange poems, The Dream Songs. But I was really moved by this novel that he tried to write and never finished during the last few years of his life, called Recovery. He tried very, very hard to stay sober. He went to rehab at Hazelden and St. Mary's, another facility in Minnesota. He did, you know, when I went to his archives at the University of Minnesota, I found many pages of step work. You know, he really threw himself into that program of recovery for various stints. He was sober for, I think, about 9 months before he relapsed, right before he committed suicide. So that kind of cyclical process of getting sober, relapsing, really characterized the last few years of his life. And in the midst of that process, he was trying to write a novel about that process. And my friend Catherine Lacey, who's a gorgeous writer, has this great way of talking about personal writing, where she says, you know, sometimes what's tricky about it is that it can be like trying to make a bed while you're still in it. And that was a wonderfully succinct way, I think, of describing some of what was happening with Berryman in that novel. Like, he was trying to make the bed while he was still in it. And that meant, I think, that the novel could never really come together. But it's a beautiful document of attempt. And you know, you can see in his archives these note cards that he wrote to himself as he was trying to figure out how to end the story, but he couldn't figure out how to end it because he couldn't really live into that ending.
Yeah. You say he could only imagine serenity in abstract terms.
Yeah, I think you see these on those note cards that I'm describing. You know, he has the main character in his novel is a professor named Alan Severance, and you know, the note cards say things like Severance felt dash fine, you know, and there's something like, you know, he was trying to imagine what it would feel like to feel fine, but he couldn't really get more specific than that about it.
I want to ask about your first AA meeting. You talk about it like wanting to cross this line, this threshold on a bridge, an actual bridge, and taking that first step. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, so by the time I went to a meeting for the first time, I had tried to stop drinking a few times, but always just on my own, had kind of white-knuckled it for, you know, a few days, a few weeks, different lengths of time, different attempts. And, you know, it was really, I went kind of crazy each time I just tried to stop drinking on my own. It felt like utter deprivation because I had come to depend on the drinking for relief, even as it was also playing this kind of toxic, corrosive role in my life. Every day I woke up and looked forward to that first drink. And so it was really, whenever I just took away the drink, it just felt like this big gaping, empty space. It wasn't that I was particularly drawn to the abstract idea of 12-step meetings, but I thought, God, it's got to be better. I need something. You know, I need something besides just me and my own relentless mind. So I went to a meeting in part because I wanted stopping drinking to feel like something besides deprivation. I wanted there to be some new kind of presence there. And I also wanted to make it harder to go back as a kind of commitment device. I felt like, well, if I start going to meetings, it'll be harder for me in 2 weeks or 2 months to talk myself back into drinking again, because I'm going to have the voices from these meetings and the kind of the memory of myself at these meetings as a kind of buffer against that sort of self-delusion or convincing myself that it would be okay to go back again. And I was really surprised by what I found at that first meeting, and particularly by, you know, I felt awkward and self-conscious. I felt all kinds of things, but I also felt from very early on this sense of relief at hearing people describe drinking in a way that made sense to me, and describe the kind of obsessive relationship to drinking in a way that made sense to me. It really felt like company.
You say that the story of your sadness was never just yours, that it always included strangers. And this idea of getting fellowship, I think that's the word you use. Hearing people talk about their experiences, that's an important part, it seems like, of your story of recovery.
Absolutely. It connects to what we were talking about with Carver's stories and how strangers sort of start to form these bonds in his fiction. I think that came probably from many places, but I think one of them was the bonds between strangers that he was witnessing and partaking in recovery. And I certainly felt always this kind of surprise and awe at, you know, you show up in a room and it's full of, you know, strangers who, if you pass them on the street, would just be these anonymous faces, and that you got to hear each of those anonymous faces sort of disclose this inner infinitude, the things that they're struggling with, the things that they're happy about that day, the things that they're grateful for. You know in the abstract that every single person you see on the street is infinite and has an infinite life, but so rarely do you actually encounter that infinitude. But meetings felt like this place where all the infinitudes were suddenly like disclosing themselves all around you. I found that deeply inspiring, and you know, it was part of, you know, if I felt like the story of my recovery included those strangers, it was part of why I wanted to write a book that included strangers as well.
You write about Bill Wilson, the founder of AA, and how he was always trying to check his own ego, never trusted his own mythology. And you say that the thing that saved him was this, the deeply honest candor of an old friend, a man named Ebby. And how that kind of honesty, I guess, opened up the idea for Wilson to this possibility of belief. Would you talk about that?
You know, Bill Wilson's story is the first chapter of, you know, what's known as the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And part of his story includes an encounter with an old friend named Ebby. And, you know, Bill Wilson is unconvinced at first. He says, I'm going to paraphrase, but he says something like, you know, my gin would last longer than his preaching. Like, he's like, okay, go ahead and talk all you want, but I actually still just want to take a drink. But, you know, there's something about that conversation with Ebby talking about what drinking had been to him and what it had meant to him to get sober, that stays with Bill Wilson and is part of what inspires both his own sobriety and this model of fellowship, where the idea is talking to another recovering alcoholic can be part of what helps you stay sober. And in addition, can be part of what helps get that other alcoholic sober. But part of what was interesting to me about Bill Wilson and spending time in his archives and seeing the many different ways he had crafted his own story for different purposes. So his story shows up one way in the Big Book. His story shows up another way when he writes it for JAMA, the medical journal. His story shows up a different way in his official autobiography. And that, to me, it was less a game of gotcha where I was like, oh, you're inconsistent. Your story shows up different ways in different places. And more that I think he was very cognizant of how when we tell our stories, we're telling them to serve some sort of purpose. And the purpose was a little bit different in each of those contexts. So, you know, I think he felt like his sobriety owed a lot to this hallucinogenic experience that he'd had in a hospital where he ended up near the end of his drinking. But when he was framing his story for Alcoholics Anonymous, he really wanted to emphasize the conversation with Ebby, because he wanted people who didn't have some kind of transcendent hallucinogenic experience, he didn't want them to feel like sobriety was out of their grasp. He wanted to say it can be as simple as having a conversation with a stranger or a friend. And that idea of like making his story serviceable and adapting it to those different contexts so it could be useful, again, it felt less like calling him out on inconsistencies and more about thinking about this larger question of what purpose do our stories serve when we tell them?
You say that trying to find the end of the mythology about the shattered drunk, you found what you call these strategies of exportation. For example, like how Raymond Carver would bring his drunk days into his sober stories. And even Amy Winehouse, how she would write these songs sober, and they were brilliant, but they were basically about drinking. And you describe it as kind of like a recipe that, like the right amount of pain could fuel the job without getting in the way of execution. Would you talk a little bit about this idea that recovery, as you say, wasn't creative death, but it also wasn't instant propulsion either?
I mean, if I went into this book with the desire to sort of push back against the connection between addiction and creativity as something absolute or the sort of, I wanted to push back against the power of that mythology. But what I ended up feeling was that the most intellectually and emotionally responsible pushback wasn't to say, okay, addiction never fuels creativity or never fuels beauty, because clearly there are many, many examples of people who have created beauty both from inside the throes of an addictive life, or certainly looking back on that addictive life, they've created beautiful work about it. But I wanted to both honor how complicated and often painful that process was, rather than sort of fetishizing or glamorizing that creative act. And I also wanted to look at the flip side and what sorts of creative activity might rise up out of recovery and wellness. But I didn't want to overcorrect by replacing one simplistic mythology with another simplistic mythology. So I didn't want to pretend like, okay, sobriety is somehow instant creative fuel or recovery is instant creative fuel. And, you know, in my own life, a lot of my early days of sobriety were spent in this kind of space of intense creative desire, but often a space of creative frustration, where I would kind of go to this coffee shop downtown. At that point, I lived in Iowa City. And you know, I missed the drinking so much, and I missed it particularly at night. You know, those were the times when I would have been drunk or would have been getting into that buzz. And instead, I was sitting in this coffee shop determined to make the sobriety worth it by writing something wonderful, you know, and that's, you know, not surprisingly, not the best way to try to write like the great American novel, you know. So I felt really frustrated often, and it was a much longer process of sobriety and recovery playing out, and eventually, I think, shaping my creative life in ways that I couldn't have quite imagined. But I didn't want to sugarcoat that story. I didn't want to make it feel like an instant transformation into sober creativity as this kind of treasure box that you can just open up and there it is.
So how has sobriety changed your approach to creativity? If you don't have access to that same kind of intensity while you're living through it, you know, being drunk or blacking out or trying to find the sweet spot of that buzz, what do you replace it with in terms of your creative life?
I think it's a question of replacing some kinds of intensity with new kinds of intensity. Yeah. So you might not have the intensity of, dramatic nights going home with strangers or that sense of like at the beginning of a night you can't see where the night is going to end up. But the truth is, at least for me, that getting sober, it made me more present in my own life. And part of that presence was, you know, not only sort of being more aware of people around me, but just being more aware of the complexities of my own experience, my relationships, my history. And because I think that, you know, most of the art that I respond to most comes from acts of attunement to the complexity of lived experience. It's like, okay, if you're awake for that complexity, you can transcribe more of it. You can reckon with more of it. And so I think sobriety for me was partially about like waking up to how complicated things are, and that became part of the art that I wanted to make or tried to make. And I also, you know, in concrete ways, my writing practice started to include all kinds of approaches that it hadn't before I got sober, and interviewing and reporting became a much bigger part of my creative process. And part of that had to do with becoming so fascinated by the lives of strangers in meetings. But also part of it came from just exercising the muscle a little bit more of, you know, maybe being nervous about encounters with strangers, or nervous about holding strangers' stories, especially when those stories are intense or hold pain. But engaging in that process a little bit more and then bringing that process into my own work. So almost all of the, you know, and I've been sober about 8 years, and in that time, my work has come to include a lot more interviewing, a lot more reporting, a lot more of kind of going out and encountering the world and listening and seeing what I can bring back into the act of writing.
Like Carver put it, you say that his poetry, when he had recovered, became more electrified by gratitude, is how you put it. And this is the thing that made me think about what you were just saying. You also described his poetry toward the end as open-nerved beholding, like a kind of awareness, and an awareness that wasn't always easy to do, probably.
Yeah, I think there's a sense of witnessing in his poetry and in his storytelling, and that act of witnessing is absolutely something that I want to make part of my own writing life and feel energized by and excited by. And you know, so I think that was yet another one of the ways that I ended up worshiping at the altar of sober Carver, as I constructed him into this kind of useful god. But there is a real electricity in a lot of his sober work. And I find that each time I return to it.
That's Leslie Jameson. Her book is called The Recovering, Intoxication, and Its Aftermath. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program directed by Tim Slover, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.